Last time we finished the chapter, The Soul and Nature, and this time we take up chapter 18, The Soul and Its Liberation. This is a larger section that Sri Aurobindo called the Yoga of Integral Knowledge when he decided to break all of these essays that he'd written in the Arya, the journal, into, well, a definition of the various kinds of yoga, leading to a yoga of self-perfection. Now, he has called this section, with his overview in the early 40s, the Yoga of Integral Knowledge. Different from the Yoga of Knowledge. So, just to recall where we are, since we're sort of midstream in this now, the traditional yoga of knowledge in the last 1500 years or so has been to confer three main branches of the yogic activity, one of knowledge, one of devotion, and one of works, the Trimarga of the Gita. Later, a fourth was added to it, Raja Yoga. And then, of course, with the development of Tantra, there were a number of yogic practices, sadhanas, that were blended into the general scheme of what was the practice of yoga, including mantra yoga, rasa yoga, etc. Nada yoga. For the traditional yoga of knowledge, aiming at the releasing of the individual consciousness from bondage to personal form, like body, your emotions, the thought stuff that occupies your mind, into something that would be real and essential and forever, a release from imprisonment in time into a permanent condition beyond time, was what the Yoga of Knowledge aimed at. It was to identify the real self in you, the true Atman, from the false Atman, or the limited Atman. Atman is a word for self. So to find this essential core of being, and to know that it is the same as the big picture, that this Atman is the same as this growing reality before us, which we call Brahman, was typal to the yoga of knowledge. So jnana yoga, jnana, J-N-A-N-A, jnana yoga, has four main features to it in the pursuit of this essential knowledge of what is being beyond time and space. One has to develop viveka, a discrimination, the ability to see behind the surface to a deeper reality. Must cultivate viraga, that is, not to be bound by the call of the senses or how delicious existence is in the phenomenal. You prefer to gain access to what is essential. Another is the cultivation of a set of virtues, the six virtues, shama, peace, dhamma, uparati, titiksha, shraddha, samadhana, mumukshutva. All of these develop in you an aspiration to put everything away, to work hard, to cultivate faith in yourself, faith in the goal, to hone your aspiration till it becomes white hot, and then to take all of this, which is building in your inner ecology, and apply it through three primary things. Shravana, Manana, Nididhyasana. So with the first, you want to listen, you want to hear from your teacher. You want to, instead of making noise with your mouth, start attending on good words, good company. You want then to dwell upon that, to think about it. So first you listen, and then you think, and then you carry thought a step farther, and you plunge into the ocean of your own inner consciousness, and there you meet this formless spirit that you are. Now, this may be the traditional yoga of knowledge, to gain release from identity with the body and the emotions and the mind stuff and all the conflicted experiences that beset us in the world. But that is only one part of the larger answer. For Sri Aurobindo, this offers us a beginning release from identity with a form, but does not offer us the larger picture of what yoga can do. So his effort to describe an integral yoga is meant to bring the world back into the picture and not to deny the individual, but to awaken the individual and awaken the individual to the value and the richness of spiritual presence in the world while attaining this high status which carries us beyond the flow of time into true being, true consciousness, and therefore true delight. But that is also here. Purnam Madaha, Purnam Idam. And we move from what is apparently darkness towards true being while keeping our firm position here. We'll come to all of this by and by, but this much to sort of set up where we are as we approach the soul and its liberation. This was an essay published for the first time in the Arya on the 15th of May, 1917. The lead article, as always, was The Life Divine. Knowledge and Immortality was the name of that essay, that month. Now, for the first time, the synthesis of yoga does not follow The Life Divine. Instead, essays on the Gita finds second place in that issue. The chapter title was The Yoga of the Intelligent Will. In other words, the Yoga of the Buddhi, Buddhi. Now, if you'll permit me, I'll just note that when I was lent a copy of Essays on the Gita 50 years ago, maybe, the first chapter that I ever had the opportunity to read on my own was The Yoga of the Intelligent Will. The third essay in that issue of Arya was The Synthesis of Yoga, and it was the 30th chapter. So, having said all that, let's begin. The soul and its liberation. We have now to pause and consider to what this acceptance of the relations of Purusha and Prakriti commits us. For it means that the yoga which we are pursuing has for end none of the ordinary aims of humanity. Again, Purusha is the term for the real person, the soul. Prakriti is the force, the combining power of nature and expression. So, soul and nature. It neither accepts our earthly existence as it is, nor can be satisfied with some kind of moral perfection or religious ecstasy, with a heaven beyond, or with some dissolution of our being by which we get satisfactorily done with the trouble of existence. So, for Sri Aurobindo, the yoga is not simply to get liberated from the world, moksha. It's not to dissolve our apparent being into some unnameable ecstatic beyond, nirvana. It is not to dwell in the heavens of the gods. It is something far more worthy of our effort. Our aim, he writes, becomes quite other. It is to live in the divine, the infinite, in God, and not in any mere egoism and temporality, but at the same time, not apart from nature, from our fellow beings, from earth and the mundane existence, any more than the divine lives aloof from us and the world. He exists also in relation to the world and nature and all these beings, but with an absolute and inalienable power, freedom, and self-knowledge. So, Sri Aurobindo is suggesting that we must be even as that divine being is, whatever it is, if it is a he, if it is a she, if it is an it. The fact that it can be this transcendent, timeless, spaceless reality and become the universe and every being in it without giving up any of its other states or phases of being is a challenge for us to do the same thing. And that is what yoga is meant to achieve, is simultaneously dwelling in all these at once, every status at once. With an absolute and inalienable power, freedom, and self-knowledge. So, inalienable, by the way, it means what cannot be transferred, what cannot be removed. It's a word that comes into the English language in the middle of the 17th century. It really has commercial and political applications. And here is Sri Aurobindo, the political warrior who's had a few years earlier been trying to drive the British out of India, left that work for others, and worked on, you might say, a larger platform, an integral yoga. But the idea is that it can't be taken away from us. This status which we seek is always ours. We don't have to find it outside us. It pre-exists. It's baked in. You are infinite. You are eternal. You are immortal. You are, in your very nature, bliss. Our liberation and perfection is to transcend ignorance, bondage, and weakness, and live in Him in relation to the world and nature with the divine power, freedom, and self-knowledge. Those words again, power, freedom, self-knowledge. Power, because a liberated consciousness is full of power. It is instinct with power. Power is one with consciousness in its origin. Because it sees truly, and it effectuates what it sees. Freedom, because when you realize that you are eternal and that you are one with the infinite, what can bind you? Freedom is a natural state. It is a spontaneous state of being. And self-knowledge is knowing what you are. Sat, real existence, has flowing out of it satya, truth, and not truth in one form, but truth in every form. All that flows out of self-realized being is in its nature an expression of truth. This goes back to the Isha Upanishad, that's the very first verse. All this is for the habitation of Isha, translated as the Lord. The universe moving in the moving universe. That means you. You are a universe. Part of a larger universe. You're the microcosm inside the macrocosm. By that renounced, in other words, by using that knowledge, give up attachment, give up grasping. By that renounced, enjoy. Once you realize you have no claim on anything, that everywhere you look, it's just that same being. And once you live in the possession of that consciousness, nothing is yours, nothing is anyone else's. It is in the conscious being of that. And then the last line is, don't lust after anyone's possession. It's almost an afterthought, isn't it? So that's the first verse of the Isha Upanishad. But think also of Bhagavad Gita, chapter 4, verse 35. Possessing that knowledge, jnana, you will not fall again into the mind's ignorance, O Pandava. For by this you will see all existences in the self, then in me. So it is the mind that is subject to ignorance because it is an organ of semi-intelligence, but an intelligence that divides, that sees a real difference between you and me, between you and that. And the difference is simply differentiation. It's not distinctness. It's not an irrevocable gulf that separates you from that. What bridges you to that is the same being, the same consciousness, all held within the experience of one mighty wave of ananda, delight. So it is the mind that falls into what Sri Aurobindo calls here ignorance, mom, confusion, delusion. We forget who we are. So then, we leave the mind, we live in the essential experience of this self, and then we see all existence is in the self. Because this one self is not simply the truth of each of us individually, but it's the truth of the larger self, of which we are an aspect, a part, a portion. And then we see, still more largely, that it's in that conscious being. So there is a supreme being who unrolls in vastitude the immortal, imperishable, impregnable, unimpeachable Brahman, and then all that becomes, exists in that spiritual reality, which is an aspect of that Supreme Person's being. Ah, so we're climbing from stage to stage. First we silence the mind, forget the dualities, then we rise to the freedom of the self, and then we rise to a higher stage, where we become one with the one who contains all this. He continues. For the highest relation of the soul to existence is the Purusha's possession of Prakriti. when he is no longer ignorant and subject to his nature, but knows, transcends, enjoys, and controls his manifested being, and determines largely and freely what shall be his self-expression. A oneness finding itself out in the variations of his own duality is the whole play of the soul with nature in its cosmic birth and becoming. Oneness, ekatvam. One satchit ananda, everywhere. Self-existent, swayambhu, illimitable. A unity indestructible by the utmost infinity of its own variations is the original truth of being for which our knowledge seeks, and to that our subjective existence eventually arrives. So, the soul on its cosmic journey enjoys the multiplicity, but it's always housed in the ineradicable oneness of this being. From that, all other truths arise. Upon that, they are based. By that, they are at every moment made possible. And in that, they in the end can know themselves and each other, are reconciled, harmonized, and justified. All relations in the world, even to its greatest and most shocking apparent discords, are relations of something eternal to itself in its own universal existence. They are not anywhere or at any time collisions of disconnected beings who meet fortuitously or by some mechanical necessity of cosmic existence. This is, of course, in Greek philosophy, ananke, necessity. No, that is not the truth of this. All the movements of nature, whatever pell-mell disorder we may see in front of us, is part of a larger whole. And this cosmic movement retraces its many paths back to its original status. They are not anywhere or at any time collisions of disconnected beings. Like it or no, we are all one family. We will have a grand reunion. It is in the very nature of things that it should be so. Therefore, to get back to this eternal fact of oneness is our essential act of self-knowledge. To live in it must be the effective principle of our inner possession of our being and of our right and ideal relations with the world. That is why we have had to insist, first and foremost, on oneness as the aim, and in a way, the whole aim of our yoga of knowledge. This we must secure in our consciousness first. Working it out practically in all the threads of our being. But this unity works itself out everywhere and on every plane by an executive or practical truth of duality. The eternal is the one infinite conscious existence, Purusha, and not something inconscient and mechanical. It exists eternally in its delight of the force of its own conscious being founded in an equilibrium of unity. But it exists also in the no less eternal delight of its force of conscious being at play with various creative self-experience in the universe. So this executrix, this practical truth of duality, is formal nature, that which forms as undertaking, the execution of the will of what is impelled by the higher nature. Conscious existence, sat, is the same thing as purusha, the reality of the individual. This idea of conscious being at play is seen, of course, in the Vedantic formula of Satchit Ananda. We've already touched upon it a few sentences ago. Sat is true existence. Chit is consciousness supreme, consciousness as power. And Ananda is, of course, delight, endless bliss. Satchit Ananda expresses itself from its unity into a manifestation of a multiplicity inside of oneness as a supramental region of being. And this idea of a conscious play we see also in the thousand names of the Divine Mother, Sri Lalita Sahasranama. The whole of the universe is a lila, a play, expressing her being, Lalitambika, the mother of delight, the mother who plays. Just as we ourselves are, or can become aware of being, always something timeless, nameless, perpetual, which we call our self, and which constitutes the unity of all that we are, and yet simultaneously we have the various experience of what we do, think, will, create, become, such too is the self-awareness of this purusha in the world. An analogy between the possibilities of our individual consciousness and its power in the world, and comparative to the divine being. Macrocosm, microcosm. Only we, being at present, limited and ego-bound mental individuals, have usually this experience in the ignorance and do not live in the self, but only look back at it or draw back to it from time to time, while the eternal has it in his infinite self-knowledge, is eternally this self, and looks from the fullness of self-being at all this self-experience. He does not, like us, bound prisoners of the mind, conceive of his being as either a sort of indefinite result and sum, or else a high contradiction of self-experience. The old philosophical quarrel between being and becoming is not possible to the eternal self-knowledge. Of course, philosophy belongs to the range of the mind, and these positions, how in the world can we recognize them? This indeed is how we arrive at an Advaita Vedanta, which insists on the oneness of the world, but only by denying the world and saying only being exists. But to that, what moves, moves inside what never moves. Again, Purnam Madaha, Purnam Idam. The one manifests the other. The eternal manifests the sempiternal, what moves in time. The other is a bridge back to the former. What moves in time is always looking for what is eternal, yearns for it, in its most conscious being, the human, denies and denies and denies death because it knows that its life hints at the eternal and wants to recapture it. This is also a truth that lies behind the impossibility of saying it is or it is not. It is not or it is. It manifests or it hides. What is there? Is there a there? There. All these questions which the mind poses cannot be formulated in the divine consciousness, because in that all oppositions are reconciled. In that, multiplicity does not deny unity, does not deny the oneness of being. So, even more, we're called to look for that. And then, having found that, to find it here. An active force of conscious being. Shakti arising from chit, Shakti arising from sat, which realizes itself in its powers of self-experience, its powers of knowledge, will, self-delight, self-formulation, with all their marvelous variations, inversions, conservations, and conversions of energy. This harkens back to Bhagavad Gita 13.22. Even perversions is what we call prakriti or nature in ourselves, as in the cosmos. But behind this force of variation is the eternal equilibrium of the same force in an equal unity, which supports impartially, governs even as it has originated the variations, and directs them to whatever aim of itself being, the Purusha, has conceived in its consciousness and determined by its will or power of consciousness. That is the divine nature, into unity with which we have to get back by our yoga of self-knowledge. So, awakening to the reality of ourselves should restore us to the power of this self, back to the Atma Shakti, which is one with the supreme nature, the divine nature, para prakriti. So we deal here with a formation of that divine nature, which serves her purposes. We call it prakriti. This is the world of the triple guna, sattva, rajas, tamas. And here, Purusha and Prakriti seem to be divided. But no, when we rise in awareness, when we become one with that which makes all one, we see the original unity and the possibility of acquiring that status again, where Purusha and Prakriti work in deliberate conscious partnership with each other, where nature rejoins spirit, where matter and the divine marry. We have to become the Purusha, Satchit Ananda, delighting in a divine individual possession of its prakriti, and no longer mental beings subject to our egoistic nature. So we use the becoming to resume being. This is how we individually fulfill the divine prototype in ourselves. And this too is a aim of Tantra. For that is the real man, the supreme and integral self of the individual. And the ego is only a lower and partial manifestation of ourselves, through which a certain limited and preparatory experience becomes possible and is for a time indulged. So we use the ego as a means of evolving consciousness through nature until we can become really self-aware. And then the ego is no longer necessary. Let's drop it to the side. We don't need it anymore. It's a mask we can discard. But this indulgence of the lower being is not our whole possibility. It is not the sole or crowning experience for which we exist as human beings, even in this material world. This individual being of ours is that by which ignorance is possible to self-conscious mind, but it is also that by which liberation into the spiritual being is possible and the enjoyment of divine immortality. This individual being, the jiva, this is how Advaita Vedanta would see the jiva as a means by which the individual becomes enmeshed and entangled, entrapped in nature. This is an inglorious insult to the real nature of the individual soul, which is powerful and luminous. It is not the eternal in his transcendence or in his cosmic being who arrives at this immortality. It is the individual who rises into self-knowledge. In him it is possessed, and by him it is made effective. So the jiva, the individual soul, rising through nature, resumes authority, acquires sovereignty, and rules its own nature. It is the individual who rises into self-knowledge, Atma-bodha. In him it is possessed. He becomes Isha, and by him it is made effective. All life, spiritual, mental, or material, is the play of the soul with the possibilities of its nature. For without this play, there can be no self-expression and no relative self-experience. If we don't manifest a huge, immeasurable universe, we don't have a playground big enough to place every possible soul. We need this universe in which to play and discover ourselves. And doesn't this phrase, all life, remind you of the opening phrases of the synthesis of yoga way back in 1914 on Sri Aurobindo's birthday, the 15th of August? All life is yoga. All life is yoga. Where are we in the scale of wakefulness depends how we can affect the world around us. And the most conscious are the most powerful. You who find the secret of your soul are the most powerful on this planet. Even then, in our realization of all as our larger self and in our oneness with God and other beings, this play can and must persist. Unless we desire to cease from self-expression and all but a tranced and absorbed self-experience. But then it is in the individual being that this trance or this liberated play is realized. The trance is this mental being's immersion in the soul experience of unity. The liberated play is the taking up of his mind into the spiritual being for the free realization and delight of oneness. For the nature of the divine existence is to possess always its unity, but to possess it also in an infinite experience. From many standpoints, on many planes, through many conscious powers or selves of itself, individualities in our limited intellectual language, of the one conscious being. Each one of us is one of these individualities. To stand away from God in limited ego, limited mind, is to stand away from ourselves, to be unpossessed of our true individuality, to be the apparent and not the real individual. It is our power of ignorance. We ignore ourselves. To be taken up into the divine being and be aware of our spiritual, infinite, and universal consciousness as that in which we now live is to possess our supreme and integral self, our true individuality. It is our power of self-knowledge. You might want to note here Bhagavad Gita, chapter 18, the last chapter, verses 54 through 57. By knowing the eternal unity of these three powers of the eternal manifestation, God, nature, and the individual self, and their intimate necessity to each other, we come to understand existence itself and all that in the appearances of the world now puzzles our ignorance. Three phases of one being. What transcends God, the divine? What is immeasurable in extent, the universe? And what is the role of the awakening soul in it? The individual, transcendent, universal, individual. Our self-knowledge abolishes none of these things. It abolishes only our ignorance and those circumstances proper to the ignorance which made us bound and subject to the egoistic determinations of our nature. When we become free inside and live in the self, we're no longer bound by the orbits of our normal mind, of whatever neurotic patterns a person may have. They're all gone. Essentially, they have no more location in that enlarged self. That is the cure for all of nature's disharmonies, is to live from the core of true being. As this supreme self, it makes itself one with all things and sees all world and nature in its own infinity. What we mean by this is simply that our sense of separate existence disappears into a consciousness of illimitable, undivided, infinite being in which we no longer feel bound to the name and form of the particular mental and physical determinations of our present birth and becoming, and are no longer separate from anything or anyone in the universe. This was what the ancient thinkers called the non-birth, asambhava, or the destruction of birth, or nirvana. At the same time, we continue to live and act through our individual birth and becoming, but with a different knowledge and quite another kind of experience. The world also continues, but we see it in our own being, and not as something external to it and other than ourselves. To be able to live permanently in this new consciousness of our real, our integral being, is to attain liberation and enjoy immortality. So consciousness contains the worlds. This is again Isha Upanishad, first verse. But the idea of the non-birth, you'll find that in verse 12 of the same, the Isha Upanishad. Deep breath, a little bit farther to go. Here there comes in the complication of the idea that immortality, amrita, is only possible after death, in other worlds, videya mukti, upon higher planes of existence, or that liberation must destroy all possibility of mental or bodily living and annihilate the individual existence forever and an impersonal infinity. So either we die or we absorb the drop back into the ocean and disappear that way. But individual existence does not continue to those schools of philosophy. These ideas derive their strength from a certain justification and experience, and a sort of necessity or upward attraction felt by the soul when it shakes off the compelling ties of mind and matter. We play with the baubles of the universe and we get tired of it. And we care not for these toys anymore. We want something more. We begin to yearn for release from it. Mumukshutva is that rising aspiration in us. It is felt that these ties are inseparable from all earthly living or from all mental existence. Death is the king of the material world, for life seems to exist here only by submission to death, by a constant dying. And the Upanishad speaks to that. Immortality has to be conquered here with difficulty and seems to be in its nature a rejection of all death and therefore of all birth into the material world. The field of immortality must be in some immaterial plane, in some heavens where either the body does not exist or else is different and only a form of the soul or a secondary circumstance. Pause for a moment. We begin our evenings together with one of the chants from the Upanishads, Asato Ma Satkamaya, put to music by Vasanti Rao in the way that we chant it. This comes from Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. This is in the first section, the third chapter, the 28th verse. And it extols what this means. Asato Ma, from non-being to real being, from darkness to light, from death to immortality. But this is an arc upwards. Look at what follows upon that in the same Upanishad. When you look at 1.4.1, it posits the self, the reality of the Atman, who says, I am, and then creates, manifests, brings forward a universe in which to have its own delight multiplied. So the idea is not even in the Upanishads, which speak of the possibility of our gaining access to this divine state of being, that we simply rest there and absolve ourselves from the universe. No. We're going to come back into the universe and enjoy this whole stadium. We're going to live in delight, coming back through the portals of time into this world itself. The field of immortality must be in some immaterial plane, in some heavens where either the body does not exist or else is different and only a form of the soul or a secondary circumstance. That's that position. On the other hand, it is felt by those who would go beyond immortality even, that all planes and heavens are circumstances of the finite existence and the infinite self is void of all these things. They are dominated by a necessity to disappear into the impersonal and infinite and an inability to equate in any way the bliss of impersonal being with the soul's delight in its becoming. So whether there's the dissolution into an absolute or we simply throw away this material world, this confinement in ignorance, and dwell in lofty heavens, neither of those are sufficient to Sri Aurobindo. He continues, philosophies have been invented, which justify to the intellect this need of immersion and disappearance. But what is really important and decisive is the call of the beyond, the need of the soul, its delight in this case in a sort of impersonal existence or non-existence. For what decides is the determining delight of the Purusha, the relation which it wills to establish with its Prakriti, the experience at which it arrives as the result of the line it has followed in the development of its individual self-experience along all the various possibilities of its nature. Our intellectual justifications are only the account of that experience which we give to the reason and the devices by which we help the mind to assent to the direction in which the soul is moving. So as is the direction of your soul, it determines its relationship with its nature. As it wakes up to itself, it wakes up the powers, the felicities that dwell inside the nature. What then do you wish to do? First, you have to awaken. Then you can find out what your goal is here. So, I know you've been waiting for me to say this. Let's put a bookmark there. We'll take up the rest of it next time. But we started a passage last week in Savitri. Let's continue it. This is in Book 1, The Book of Beginnings, Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge. And we'll start towards the bottom of page 61. Here on the earth, where we must fill our parts, we know not how shall run the drama's course. Our uttered sentences veil in their thought. Her mighty plan she holds back from our sight. She has concealed her glory and her bliss and disguised the love and wisdom in her heart. Of all the marvel and beauty that are hers, only a darkened little we can feel. He too wears a diminished godhead here. He has forsaken his omnipotence, his calm he has foregone, and infinity. He knows only her. He has forgotten himself. To her he abandons all to make her great. He hopes in her to find himself anew, incarnate, wedding his infinity's peace to her creative passion's ecstasy. Although possessor of the earth and heavens, he leaves to her the cosmic management and watches all, the witness of her scene. A supernumerary on her stage, he speaks no words or hides behind the wings. He takes birth in her world, waits on her will, divines her enigmatic gestures sense. The fluctuating chance turns of her mood, works out her meanings she seems not to know, and serves her secret purpose in long time. As one too great for him, he worships her. He adores her as his regent of desire. He yields to her as the mover of his will. He burns the incense of his nights and days, offering his life a splendor of sacrifice, a rapt solicitor for her love and grace. His bliss in her to him is his whole world. He grows through her in all his being's powers. He reads by her God's hidden aim in things. Or a courtier in her countless retinue, content to be with her and feel her near, he makes the most of the little that she gives, and all she does drapes with his own delight. A glance can make his whole day wonderful. A word from her lips with happiness wings the hours. He leans on her for all he does and is. He builds on her largesses, his proud, fortunate days, and trails his peacock-plumaged joy of life, and suns in the glory of her passing smile. In a thousand ways he serves her royal needs. He makes the hours pivot around her will, makes all reflect her whims. All is their play. This whole wide world is only he and she. Namaste, Jai Ma.